Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, the Blake Society's Stephen Pritchard and poet John Sadiq explore the similarities between two hugely influential writers and artists, William Blake and Khalil Gibran. Both were poets and artists who both dabbled in prophetic vision. Their readings of the Bible, their rebellion against church corruption, and their socio-political visions were very similar. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, join us for an exploration of the work of these iconic poets of prophetic vision.
My name's Stephen Pritchard. Some of you might have been in the last session, so forgive me on that. I'm secretary of the Blake Society, and we're here to work with Blake and Khalil Gibran. If you're not a member of the Blake Society, either look us up, just put Blake Society into Google. I've got a few cards left. I brought hundreds, but they all went in the last event. I think there's still a couple around. If you're really keen, come and get one. It's a nice picture of Albion and a Blake quotation on the back. Where shall we take our stand to view the infinite and unbounded? But you can easily look us up online. Last year, I met John Sadiq, who is a wonderful man, and we immediately got on. John's a poet and a musician and a spiritual teacher. He's written a lot of books. And we talked to, he was doing an event on Gibran. I was just there as a guest. We talked about Blake and Gibran. And this is my first Blake book that I bought. I've now got nearly 200 books on or by Blake, on and about Blake, different editions. This tiny one was my intro. And the brilliant thing about it, I bought it at school when I was 15, one of those touring exhibitions, is that it hasn't got just the early stuff that almost all collections have, and sometimes people get no further than Songs of Innocence and of Experience, which are amazing, of course, and deceptively simple, but it also has bits from his notebook, and it has bits from the major prophecies, just little bits, but it was enough to ravish me and entice me. And at the same time, I bought The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, and what drew me in to that was this picture and the text. Just glancing at the text, it seemed quite amazing. And John and I put the images together. We both found one that we liked. And you can see the eyes in the background there of the seated figure, and there's swirling bodies around the outside, just as you get the swirl here. In the previous event, we saw that pretty much in the book of Job, those sort of angelic things. And we're going to do something a bit different from just chatting.
Yeah. So just a little history as well. I picked up The Prophet at the age of 15. In fact, we actually have exactly the same edition. It's just I've lost my dust cover. And I had this friend who will remain nameless because he descended into terrible heroin addiction and so on over time, but I didn't. And we decided, we used to kind of just... The world just didn't feel right to us somehow. We felt like complete oddities in the world. And we decided to actually read The Prophet and use it as a guide to help us with our lives, because around us was all kind of sort of poverty, drugs. You know, I come from a really rough sort of town. My mother was kind of very violent and so on. And, Rochdale back in the 80s, it was like National Front and all that sort of stuff. So we started living by The Prophet. And I still turn to The Prophet to this day, you know, as a poet. One thing people don't realise is you think you're writing poems, but then whenever there's a birth, a death, or a marriage, you get these requests, kind of thing. Can you come and do this? Or can you come and do that? And I found that Gibran is always very helpful in those times. And what's interesting about Gibran is he became better known for the art first. It was the art that got known first, and then sort of the poetry started kind of coming in. And he's patchy, actually, at times. But when he's good, there's nothing better, quite honestly. And so what we've decided for today is to do something a little bit different. Stephen and I were talking about last year is the frustration of coming to an event like this and people talking about things. You think that sounds like a good thing, but actually, mostly what you get is opinion. That person's opinion and their ego and so on. And sometimes it can be enlightening, but you never get to hear the work. So we're going to just read to you, basically. You're going to hear Blake and Gibran. That's what we're going to do. And then you can ask the questions. And I'm a lover of poetry, a lover of literature, as is Stephen. And if you throw the expert away, you can get your heart back. So that's the approach we've decided to take. I hope that's okay for you. Yeah, so we found intersections between Blake and Gibran, and we chose six intersections. I'm not sure we'll get through all of the stuff. Of course, Gibran comes after Blake, 130 years, I think it is, between them. But Gibran always credited Blake as kind of being a huge influence for him. And in my own lineage, because I believe that if you're a poet, you should follow your lineage back of the stuff you love, you get Blake, you get Gibran, you get Whitman, you get Allen Ginsberg, and if you keep following the line, well, I'm sitting here right now, and I am the product of those people before me. So whenever I write, whether I know it or not, there's a conversation going all the way back to Blake and to kind of what comes before. So should we start with Divinity Within?
We can.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, I hadn't made the connection completely at 15, and I went going back to the fly leaf, which I probably hadn't read because I was so keen to get into the book, it makes it explicit. And George Russell, who was a friend of Yeats, who brought Blake to the world, really, in terms of publishing the first complete edition of his works. So George Russell writes about Gibran being influenced by Blake and suggests that Rodin in Paris introduced Gibran to Blake. All I'd say is, in terms of influence, I think they drink from exactly the same well. So it may well be, for my money, that Gibran just recognised a completely twin soul in Blake.
Yeah, and Gibran sure. drank as well. So.
Yeah. Yeah, Blake didn't... I think he'd like to drop a veil. So we're starting
Let's
with
do it.
Divinity Within.
Yeah.
We're thinking about standing to this, but...
We can.
I don't know if we'll be lit. If we look all shadowy in the face area.
It feels wrong to sit down to read things out, doesn't it?
Yeah, okay. It feels a bit weird.
Would you like to go first?
I don't mind. You go first.
Okay, I'll go first. So I'm going to lean on the prophet a lot, but I'm going to come out from the prophet as well. So I'm basically representing Khalil Gibran today in this boxing match. You know, it'd be quite good, actually, wouldn't it? I kind of put him up, Blake, you know. But something that is truly remarkable, I felt, about the prophet and Gibran, regardless of his biography, this is the thing that's what I was saying about not really wanting to be the expert, because I have no interest in biography. In fact, when you read about people, it usually ruins it for you. So I'll just stick to the poems, thank you very much, you know. And then that lets you have access to art. Something I felt both in Gibran and in Blake is the calling to self-knowledge, the calling to know who you actually are within yourself, and literally the divinity and the beauty of our human selves. And when I, you know, hold my meditation retreats and teach and so on, I'm not being some airy-fairy kind of person saying believe in this and believe in that. All I want is that people know the truth of themselves. And we all know that, because if you feel into yourself, there's a part of you that has always felt like yourself, but then the conditioning is applied on top of that. You see, I'm sorry, I'm going into spiritual teacher mode here. When we work with real spirituality or real religion, the religion that's beyond religion, it actually is like an unearthing of who you really are, and you find that conditioning starts to come away. So I want to read a little bit from the introduction at the beginning of the prophet, where Gibran is kind of embodying al-Mustafa, the prophet himself, and he sees his ship coming. So I'll read you this, just a little bit from that section. The sea that calls all things unto her calls me, and I must embark. For to stay, though the hours burn in the night, is to freeze and crystallize and be bound in a mold. Fain would I take with me all that is here, but how shall I? A voice cannot carry the tongue, and the lips that gave it wings. Alone must it seek the ether. And alone and without his nest, shall the eagle fly across the sun. Now, when he reached the foot of the hill, he turned towards the sea again, and he saw his ship approaching the harbor, and upon her prow the mariners, the men of his own land. And his soul cried out to them, and he said, "Sons of my ancient mother, you riders of the tides, how often you have sailed in my dreams. And now you come to me in my awakening, which is my deeper dream. Ready am I to go, and my eagerness with sails full set awaits the wind. Only another breath will I breathe in this still air, only another loving look cast backward, and then I shall prepare to stand among you, a seafarer among seafarers, and you, vast sea, sleepless mother, who alone are peace and freedom to the river and the stream. Only another winding will this stream make, only another murmur in this glade, and then I shall come to you, a boundless drop to a boundless ocean." And I just want to follow that with a small poem by Gibran that doesn't get collected very often, called Fear, which literally follows straight on from that. "It is said that before entering the sea, a river trembles with fear. She looks back at the path she has traveled from the peaks of the mountains, the long winding road crossing forests and villages. And in front of her, she sees an ocean so vast that to enter there seems nothing more than to disappear forever. But there is no other way. The river cannot go back. Nobody can go back. To go back is impossible in existence. The river needs to take the risk of entering the ocean, because only then will fear disappear, because that's where the river will know it's not about disappearing into the ocean, but of becoming the ocean."
That's beautiful. I'm going to start with a bit of prose from Blake on the theme of divinity within, from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which is a mixture of poetry and prose. And Blake adopts all sorts of attitudes in this. And this bit is often quoted, and it could have come in the category of critique of organized religion, because Blake was against anything which fossilized religion and made it just the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. But it also traces how we lose contact with nature and the spiritual aspects of nature, which of course Blake saw as aspects of ourself. And so this is about, it's actually about people losing that sense of divinity within. But of course, in reminding us of that, Blake points to the fact that that's where the divine resides. And it goes like this. "The ancient poets animated all sensible objects with gods or geniuses, calling them by the names and adorning them with the properties of woods, rivers, mountains, lakes, cities, nations, and whatever their enlarged and numerous senses could perceive. And particularly they studied the genius of each city and country, placing it under its mental deity, till a system was formed, which some took advantage of and enslaved the vulgar by attempting to realize or abstract the mental deities from their objects. Thus began priesthood, choosing forms of worship from poetic tales. And at length, they pronounced that the gods had ordered such things. Thus, men forgot that all deities reside in the human breast." And then a poem from Songs of Innocence. And you may know Blake wrote Songs of Innocence, and then some years later, Songs of Innocence and of Experience, showing two contrary states of the human soul. And neither are sort of final states for Blake. Through imagination, you can travel beyond innocence and experience. They are states that we pass through. Innocence generally associated with childhood, and experience being a world in which children are very likely to suffer at the hands of unscrupulous adults, of the usual thing of, you know, boys and girls being forced up chimneys and so on, just exploited. So this is from Innocence. It's called The Divine Image. To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God, our Father dear, and mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child and care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress, prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form in heathen, Turk or Jew. Where mercy, love and pity dwell, their God is dwelling too. So, of course, Blake's first engraved work is All Religions Are One. And he's not saying that all religions are the same, but he's saying for him they all come from the same source. And of course, the words that he uses in terms of heathen and Turk strike our ears rather jarringly these days. But Blake was intensely interested and respectful of other religions and of other literature. He'd read the Bhagavad Gita. I once described Blake to some Qawwali exponents, some of the finest in the world, as an English Sufi, because his values and attitudes are so much of that. So that's my little offering for that heading.
I'd wondered if he'd been reading the Gita, you know, because I was looking at Jerusalem.
Yes.
And I'm sure there's a bit about the chakras in there. Seriously, he talks about these four points within the body.
Yes.
And kind of if you aliven those parts.
Yes.
So it's like he's kind of, you know, he's almost like heading towards yoga, isn't
yes.
he?
Yes, yes.
At times, which I found really interesting.
He's very aware of the Kabbalah as well, the Jewish mystical source of the Bhagavad Gita. It just goes on and on, really.
Yeah, and the same with Gibran. There's Sufism in there and all sorts. Kind of gets pulled in in the same sort of way.
Yeah.
Actually, fantastic.
Yeah. He's very concerned with the fourfold and, really, mandalas.
Yeah. They're
very much part of what he uses in his own artwork in different forms.
Yeah, I love that poem very much. It's brilliant. Brilliant. In my own work, I think of a poem that Stephen just read, kind of... you know, if we kind of let go of religion, as it were, and Gibran is saying the same thing a lot of the time, it comes down to being love and mercy and the virtues in that way that actually are the aspect of God in the human sort of system, not the things that we believe in, which are additions to us. And I think they're both kind of trying to guide us home all the time with this, aren't they?
Yes, yes. You know? So Blake turns it round. I'll just say one little thing about that. So in Songs of Experience, he has the human abstract,
right,
which is the cynical counterpart. Neither of these are Blake's voices. He's just taking those points of view. That starts, pity would be no more if we did not make somebody poor. So it's he takes the same words and takes it from a different angle. But of course, this one of innocence is very much part of Blake's worldview as well.
Yeah, he kind of sets his store out there, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And just like at the beginning of The Prophet, Gibran is kind of setting out, you know, how things go. Shall we critique organized religion then?
Absolutely.
Okay, there you go. So this is... Where's my glasses? This is Gibran, again, from The Prophet. And an old priest said, "Speak to us of religion." And he said, "Have I spoken of aught else this day? It is not religion. Is not religion all deeds and all reflection? And that which is neither deed nor reflection, but a wonder and a surprise ever springing in the soul, when even while the hands hew the stone or tend the loom, who can separate his faith from his actions or his belief from his occupations? Who can spread his hours before him, saying, 'This for God and this for myself, this for my soul and this other for my body'? All your hours are wings, what beat through space from self to self. He who wears his morality, but as his best garment, were better naked. The wind and the sun will tear no holes in his skin. And he who defines his conduct by ethics imprisons his songbird in a cage. The freest song comes not through bars and wires. And he to whom worshipping is a window to open but also to shut has not yet visited the house of his soul whose windows are from dawn to dawn. Your daily life is your temple and your religion. Whenever you enter into it, take with you your all. Take plough and forge and the mallet and the lute, the things you have fashioned in necessity or for delight. For in reverie, you cannot rise above your achievements nor fall lower than your failures. And take with you all men, for in adoration, you cannot fly higher than their hopes nor humble yourself lower than their despair. And if you would know God, be not therefore a solver of riddles. Rather, look about you, and you shall see him playing with your children. And look into space, you shall see him walking in the cloud, outstretched his arms in the lightning and the descending rain. You shall see him smiling in flowers, then rising and waving his hands in the trees.
Waving his hands in the trees.
Gibran can be actually a tricky read. It looks so simple, but actually the tongue and Gibran are kind of take some work to put together sometimes. Actually, he does. He kind of slips and slides a bit around, so it's really quite interesting, sort of poetically.
So the rhythms and the cadences are just
Sometimes the beats can be quite interesting with Gibran,
yes,
as it were, you know. Yeah.
Kidoki, Critique of Organized Religion from Blake. Which is songs of experience, a couple of those. The first of all, the Garden of Love. I went to the Garden of Love, and I saw what I never had seen. A chapel was built in the midst, where I used to play on the green. And the gates of this chapel were shut, and thou shalt not writ over the door. So I turned to the Garden of Love, that so many sweet flowers bore. And I saw it was filled with graves and tombstones where flowers should be. And priests in black gowns were walking their rounds and binding with briars my joys and desires. And Blake, of course, makes much of the very positive side to desire. And although at points... or perhaps it's not in any way different from Buddhism, which often desire is counted in that as something that we can lose suffering by losing desire. But maybe I'm misinterpreting that, John.
Well, the thing with, I'm not a Buddhist, but I kind of have studied that at great length. And the thing with desire within Buddhism, a lot of things that are not explained sometimes, is there can be this sort of nihilistic sort of way of looking at things. But actually, we have to look at where our desire actually is arising from. And so if it's rising from something unhealed within the self, this is quite Jungian, what I'm about to say now, is that it will then project outwards. So if you end up in sort of codependent relationships or having to kind of strongly identify with the tribe in order to have an idea of yourself and things like that, you know, so nationalism, patriotism and so on, all come out of the desire to actually be whole, but can be very broken and kind of warped by that. So that's kind of the deeper version of that viewpoint.
That's really cool.
But desire doesn't need to be got rid of, because true desires, once we start realizing the self or the true divinity within, as we're talking about here, then your desires become natural.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
Which is, Blake will talk about like the energy and so on.
Yes.
At that point.
Blake is talking about repression, isn't
yeah.
he? Really? That's, yeah. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
Exuberance is beauty, he says. He's got that great sense of the positive energy of desire. He says in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, so which is a very provocative text, energy is the only life and is from the body. Blake reasserts that balance between mind and body and breaks that dualism that was set up in the Enlightenment, where we become divided beings between mind and body, between soul and body. It becomes very much all one for him. Here's the little vagabond, again from Songs of Experience. Dear mother, the church is cold, but the alehouse is healthy and pleasant and warm. Besides, I can tell where I am used well. Such usage in heaven will never do well. But if at the church they would give us some ale and a pleasant fire our souls to regale, we'd sing and we'd pray all the livelong day, nor ever once wish from the church to stray. Then the parson might preach and drink and sing, and we'd be as happy as birds in the spring. And modest Dame Lurch, who is always at church, would not have bandy children, nor fasting, nor birch. And God, like a father, rejoicing to see his children as pleasant and happy as he, would have no more quarrel with the devil or the barrel, but kiss him and give him both drink and apparel. Blake has a great sense of humour, which isn't something we always find in great literature.
No.
But he's got it in huge amounts, something I love very much about him, one of the many things.
Gibran could be funnier, actually, couldn't he? You know, he could do a tickling stick, doesn't he? Gibran at times.
I think he's got everything he needs.
Yeah.
Our eldest son got married last October in Southern Ireland, and they asked me, without any reference to whether I like Gibran or not, to read Gibran.
Did you read The Marriage or The Love?
It was Love.
Love. Oh,
which
nice
is,
segue.
Yeah, which segue. We're going to hear, aren't we? We're going to hear that. Which
it's almost like we planned this, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Now, I thought they might go for Marriage, but when I read Love, I thought, that's amazing.
Isn't it just?
But it's, like Blake, it's got a very hard edge to it, too. It's uncompromising.
Absolutely, yeah, and I love that.
It's about that suffering might be involved, but hey, let's do it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's love.
Yeah. And that's something we do need to consider, you know, in the kind of the modern mind tends to think of love as being some wishy-washy thing. Yeah. But actually, you know, if love is actually applied, it changes everything. You know, when it wakens up in ourselves, it changes everything. If we were to apply some actual love in our world right now, things would not be as they are, you know. And so, you know, this reading from the prophet kind of is, for me, a very strong reminder. You know, this is not a book from 1922. This is here and now, basically, you know. And that is the thing with both Blake and Gibran, in that the relevance has actually got stronger, not faded away with time in many ways of these works. I'm going to read from the book. It's driving me nuts reading out of a folder because I've got, like, shiny pages. There's a bit I have to do from there, but I'll stick to my books. It's funny, I was doing a thing last night. Everybody's reading off phones and digital devices, right, for their poetry last night. And I come out with all this pile of books, and I felt like so old-fashioned, quite honestly. I was like, oh, I am the old man now, you know. But I'm all for books, I'm afraid. Mm. So there's nothing the same as a book, actually.
Blake made his.
Yeah, that's right.
And invented a new method of printing.
Wow.
And his wife, Catherine Blake, did a lot of the colouring. We now realise that it isn't Blake, it's Blake's. The Blake's team. Yeah,
fantastic, the Blake's. When love beckons to you, follow him, though his ways are hard and steep. And when his wings enfold you, yield to him. Though the sword hidden amongst his pinions may wound you. And when he speaks to you, believe in him, though his voice may shatter your dreams as the north wind lays waste to the garden. For even as love crowns you, so shall he crucify you. Even as he is for your growth, so he is for your pruning. Even as he ascends to your height and caresses your tenderest branches that quiver in the sun, so shall he descend to your roots and shake them in their clinging to the earth. Like sheaves of corn, he gathers you unto himself. He threshes to make you naked. He sifts you to free you from your husks. He grinds you to whiteness. He kneads you until you are pliant, and then he assigned you to his sacred fire that you may become sacred bread for God's sacred feast. All these things shall love do unto you, that you may know the secrets of your heart, and in that knowledge become like a fragment of life's heart. But if in you fear would seek only love's peace or love's pleasure, then it is better for you that you cover your nakedness and pass out of love's threshing floor into the seasonless world where you shall laugh, but not all of your laughter, and weep, but not all of your tears. Love gives naught but itself and takes naught but from itself. Love possesses, nor would it be possessed. For love is sufficient unto love. When you love, you should not say, God is in my heart, but rather, I am in the heart of God. And think not you can direct the course of love, for if it finds you worthy, it directs your course. Love has no other desire but to fulfill itself. But if you love and must needs have desires, let these be your desires. To melt and be like a running brook that sings its melody into the night. To know the pain of too much tenderness. To be wounded by your own understanding of love and to bleed willingly and joyfully. To wake at dawn with a winged heart and give thanks for another day of loving. To rest at the noon hour and meditate love's ecstasy. To return home at eventide with gratitude. And then to sleep with a prayer for the beloved in your heart and a song of praise upon your lips.
Isn't that lovely?
And that connects with the desires within the Blake poem, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Very clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just that's gorgeous, gorgeous. So, I've got two bits here for love. One, because we've got love and compassion, and we've got one for more love. Well, they've both got compassion. They're both about, stop gibbering about it. So this one might be very personal to Blake. People conjecture. It's called William Bond, and there's a clue in the William. People conjecture whether Blake was tempted to have an affair at this point, and Catherine's reaction and her sadness and how he came round to not doing it because of how much it impacted on her. But we don't know. That's conjecture. William Bond. I wonder whether the girls are mad, and I wonder whether they mean to kill, and I wonder if William Bond will die, for assuredly he is very ill. He went to church in a May morning, attended by fairies, 1, 2, 3. But the angels of providence drove them away, and he returned home in misery. He went not out to the field nor fold. He went not out to the village nor town, but he came home in a black, black cloud and took to his bed and there lay down. And an angel of providence at his feet and an angel of providence at his head, and in the midst a black, black cloud, and in the midst the sick man on his bed. And on his right hand was Mary Green, and on his left hand was his sister Jane, and their tears fell through the black, black cloud to drive away the sick man's pain. Oh, William, if thou dost another love better than poor Mary, go and take that other to be thy wife, and Mary Green shall her servant be. Yes, Mary, I do another love, another I love far better than thee, and another I will have for my wife. Then what have I to do with thee? For thou art melancholy pale, and on thy head is the cold moonshine. But she is ruddy and bright as day, and the sunbeams dazzle from her eyne. Mary trembled, and Mary chilled, and Mary fell down on the right-hand floor, that William Bond and his sister Jane scarce could recover Mary more. When Mary woke and found her laid on the right hand of her William dear, on the right hand of his loved bed, and saw her William Bond so near, the fairies that fled from William Bond danced around her shining head. They danced over the pillow white, and the angels of providence left the bed. I thought love lived in the hot sunshine, but oh, he lives in the moony night. I thought to find love in the heat of day, but sweet love is the comforter of night. Seek love in the pity of another's woe, in the gentle relief of another's care, in the darkness of night and the winter's snow, in the naked and outcast. Seek love there. Whew. That one makes me go a bit peculiar.
Yes.
It just broadens, doesn't it?
It opens everything up, doesn't it?
Love relationship into in the naked and outcast, seek love there. And that just knocks me over. I had to sit down suddenly. Oh, another one. Get up again. Okay, so this is from his longest work, which he never published. It was a manuscript, very, very long, Vela or the Four Zoas. The two alternative titles, but he didn't ever decide which to call it, and it was never finished, it was never engraved. But it has got some of his greatest verse, and some of it he uses in the two major prophecies he did finish in Milton and Jerusalem. And this is Enion. She's a female figure. She's the female half of Tharmas. So Tharmas and Enion are a pair, and she has been driven into the void of non-entity. And in the manuscript, you can actually see her fading. Blake describes it as the margin of non-entity in the verse. You could actually see her on the margin of the page. And they were so poor, he's done it on proofs for a commercial work that he did, the illustrations to somebody else's work, and he's used the back, as we might use spare paper of the ones that didn't print so well. It goes like this. I'm going to abridge it slightly, but it's something that's often cited and read, and you may have heard it, you may have not. Happy blindness, Enion sees not the terrors of the uncertain. Thus Enion wails from the dark deep, and the gold heavens tremble. My heavens are brass, my earth is iron, my moon a clod of clay, my sun a pestilence burning at noon, and a vapour of death in night. What is the price of experience? Do men buy it for a song? Or wisdom for a dance in the street? No, it is bought with the price of all that a man hath, his house, his wife, his children. Wisdom is sold in the desolate market where none come to buy, and in the withered field where the farmer ploughs for bread in vain. It is an easy thing to triumph in the summer sun, and in the vintage, and to sing on the wagon loaded with corn. It is an easy thing to talk of patience to the afflicted, to speak the laws of prudence to the houseless wanderer, to listen to the hungry ravens cry in wintry season, when the red blood is filled with wine and with the marrow of lambs. It is an easy thing to laugh at wrathful elements, to hear the dog howl at the wintry door, the ox in the slaughterhouse moan, to see a god on every wind and a blessing on every blast, to hear sounds of love in the thunderstorm that destroys our enemy's house, to rejoice in the blight that covers his field and the sickness that cuts off his children, while our olive and vine sing and laugh round our door and our children bring fruits and flowers. Then the groan and the dolor are quite forgotten, and the slave grinding at the mill, and the captive in chains, and the poor in the prison, and the soldier in the field, when the shattered bone hath laid him groaning among the happier dead. It is an easy thing to rejoice in the tents of prosperity. Thus could I sing and thus rejoice, but it is not so with me. Wow. So yeah. Compassion, I thought.
Yes, absolutely. That one. I just think it made me think of a line. There's a wonderful Indian spiritual teacher, long dead now. Well, not long dead, but recently, you know, in the last sort of 30, 40 years, gone, called Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. And he used to say that that compassion was love in action when you truly meet another person's pain. So it's the active principle of love, which kind of feeds into into this. Yeah. We're kind of at time for questions, but I was going to read to you from a thing called The New Frontier, which is a much lesser known essay by Gibran. Well, we're not going to have time for that. But this comes from 1925. And there was I wanted to point a line out, point it out to Stephen, and he was like, "Oh my God, is that where that comes from?" And but we're not going to get to it. So what I'll do is, because it's out of copyright, I have a Substack, like a kind of blog. So if you look for the Sadiq Space on Substack, I'll publish it next week on there, and you can read the whole essay. I'll stick it on there. But I just wanted to kind of very quickly give you this, and then can I close? Can I have a quick Gibran poem? Which kind of it was to rouse us at the end, you see.
Yes, yes.
So we'll do that, and then we'll go to questions. So I'll just read you this bit from The New Frontier, then we'll jump to Do Not Love Half Lovers. There are today, in 1925, right? There are today in the Middle East two men, one of the past and one of the future. Which one are you? Come and tell me who and what you are. Are you a politician asking what your country can do for you, or are you a zealous one asking what you can do for your country? Recognize that? Yeah? So Gibran and John F. Kennedy, there you go. That's all I'll read you from that. But if you want to see the whole thing, I'll put it on the Sadiq Space next week. You know, just look on Substack. I'll close out with this for Gibran. Again, a kind of piece that's not collected very often, but has just such an effect. Do not love half lovers. Do not entertain half friends. Do not indulge in works of the half talented. Do not live half a life and do not die half a death. If you choose silence, then be silent. When you speak, do so until you are finished. Do not silence yourself to say something and do not speak to be silent. If you accept, then express it bluntly. Do not mask it. If you refuse, then be clear about it, for an ambiguous refusal is but a weak acceptance. Do not accept half a solution. Do not believe half truths. Do not dream half a dream. Do not fantasize about half hopes. Half a drink will not quench your thirst. Half a meal will not satiate your hunger. Half the way will get you nowhere. Half an idea will bear you no results. Your other half is not the one you love. It is you in another time, yet in the same space. It is you when you are not. Half a life is a life you did not live, a word you have not said, a smile you have postponed, a love you have not had, a friendship you did not know, to reach and not arrive, work and not work, attend only to be absent. What makes you a stranger to them closest to you and they strangers to you? That half is merely a moment of inability. But you are able, for you are not half a being. You are a whole that exists to live a life, not half a life. So there. Should we
Brilliant.
Open?
Should we? Yes.
Yes.
Throw the floor open to questions.
If you have any questions. We could have gone on for days if you let us.
We've got enough material for the rest of the day, really.
Thank you. That was wonderful. I have a question for John. You were saying that you chose to use the prophet as a guide.
Yes.
How has that gone? And what were the challenges? Were there challenges?
It was really interesting because, you know, a 15-year-old lad in Rochdale not knowing his arse from his elbow, quite honestly, and then, you know, looking at the true meaning of friendship, for example, if you look at the section on friendship, that to me was one of the very first things that kind of grabbed me. But, you know, here I am, I'm 60 in a few weeks' time, so 45 years later, and I feel that what I kind of learned through this is kind of how I don't like the word teacher, but I hold spaces for people. And I was even just thinking just now, crikey, wouldn't it be the most amazing thing to have like a weekend retreat where you have like meditation and readings of Blake and Gibran poems and then a bit of writing or something, a bit of writing, a bit of sitting in nature. I think we're coming up with something here. Yeah. And we'll entertain you and then we'll use these as reflections. But that'd be wild, you know? So that's it, we're having that.
And yeah,
so it's gone really well to answer the question. And of course, we all go through sort of strange times, but like, you know, with what Gibran is saying about love, you know, you reflect on the world right now and people will say they love all sorts of things. But if they actually let love be an active principle within them, it would tear all that stuff down. It would tear it all away. Imagine if a politician allowed love. And so my process was literally to take what Gibran was saying, because I had no other guide. My dad was gone, absent. My mum was absolutely bonkers, you know, hospital bonkers, you know. And so I needed a dad. So Gibran became my dad in many ways. And then Malcolm X after that, and then the poets that I loved, and so on, Whitman and on from there. So I think you can't do wrong. You know, if you have a 15-year-old kid, if a copy of The Prophet lands in their Christmas pile or their birthday pile, you would not go far wrong. And there's things I will disagree with it now. There's bits where, you know, he's pushing it a bit there, you know, like the bit on teaching is really quite interesting. And there's stuff that might be interesting to have a conversation with him about if he was still around. But yeah, I think it's a beautiful thing to do. So Prophet for Christmas. To everybody, you know.
Not for profit.
Not for profit. The profit, not for profit. Yeah.
I like the idea of your event, John.
Shall we do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to do that. Register your interest, please, at the counter outside.
That was amazing. Well worth getting up for on a Sunday morning. I think we'd all agree. I absolutely loved The Prophet. And what I find is that I have children, teenage children. First of all, trying to engage them in any way, some advice would be really appreciated. And also, I'm what are your thoughts about it not being on the school syllabus at all? Gibran's The Prophet would work so well on the school syllabus. And yet it's nowhere to be seen as a great work, just even as a great work, and one that, you know, it's complex but easy enough for teenagers to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, at that age, you'd be reading like Hermann Hesse, you know, yeah. Gibran, the Siddhartha and so on. Mm-hmm. Is Blake on the syllabus?
Yes, sometimes.
Yeah, and what tends to end up on the syllabus? Is it Innocence Experience?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't get into the nitty gritty much.
This is my partner here. We both taught Blake to, as English teachers, in other lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what to answer your question, and I have to kind of dip into myself here and look from the love that Gibran is talking about. Teaching is not what it's supposed to be, and we have to be honest about that. While I hold teachers in high regard, and this is one of the things I would disagree with Gibran, you see. It's also used as a political weapon. Mm. And so if we look at, say, India and Modi and what he's doing with, you know, literally rewriting the history books and how each government will come in and literally change what's taught within history, you know. So, like, if we look at Britain, for example, the people of Britain do not know the effect of their history on other countries, you know, and that's why you get what you have in the world, as you have populism and nationalism and so on kind of taking such root, because there is the greatness of my nation and all that kind of bullshit kind of placed at the center of everything, and no love, no questioning of the human spirit, no allowing of the human spirit. So the schooling is not built around the progression of the individual to actually individuate and to know themselves fully, and then to access opportunity based on that, is based on quite literally pushing people into the school and university system in this country now is about pushing you into STEM degrees, where you can then become part of a particular machine of economics, which will lead to the industrial military complex. If you think about it, that's what's there. If you apply what's actually in The Prophet, then you couldn't manipulate people in that way. Mm. So it is actually the antithesis of modern teaching. Yeah. That's why it's not there.
I couldn't agree. I mean, yeah. It really should be
Sorry,
available.
Sorry, I'm talking
in,
a bit.
Not at
you know,
all
strong.
In the syllabus. Yeah. Certainly, I think we found that young people respond really well to Blake because of the contraries that he gives in Innocence and Experience, you know, at that level. And the artwork, I used to have a teaching room with lots of Blake artwork. Not quite like that one, but quite a lot of Blake artwork, and of course with text and image, because he had a new method of printing to print the two together. And I used to ask the students when they thought these pictures were made, and they never, ever guessed earlier than the 1970s. And of course, we're talking 18th turn of the 19th century, so, yeah.
I'm just thinking, to kind of follow on from that. So what you can do as parents is you make sure there's good books in the house.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
And throw the homework away, and so you're not doing that crap. You know, here, read Gibran for your homework. Mm. Read some Blake, you know, read a bit of Walt Whitman. Read Songs of Innocence and Experience, Song of Myself by Walt Whitman, you know, which follows on very nicely from what we're talking about here, actually.
These things can, as you're saying with Gibran, things can be very used in the wrong way and in different ways. And Did Those Feet in Ancient Time was written originally as put to music by Parry, I should say. So the lyric was there. It was part of it's a preface to a 2,000-line poem in which Milton recognises, Blake has Milton in Unhappy Though in Heaven, and he realises he's been an absolute bastard to his three wives and three children, returns to Earth to try and put that right and recognise the equal value of the feminine. That's where that poem comes in, you know, and Did Those Feet in Ancient Time. When it was written, it was acquired first for the First World War effort, and then Parry took it away, gave it to the suffragette movement. And then, you know, it was taken on variously by the Labour Party, by the National Front. Blake would have been astounded and appalled, completely appalled by those, some of those usages of his lyric.
Yeah. What I take from the, Jerusalem, in what we're talking about from the sort of like the Gibran side of it, is if you actually live these principles that we're talking about, mercy, compassion, love, and so on, then the world is actually made into the New Jerusalem. Mm. That's what it is. So it's actually the truest spiritual expression. Mm. So to see it corrupted in this kind of, nationalistic way or whatever is an absolute, affront to the work.
Yeah.
You know? We need to stop.
We do.
We do. Before we give them heart attacks.
I was just going to tell them about Bob Dylan's video for...
Oh, absolutely.
He's taking the... and Allen Ginsberg is in the back.
He is, he's hiding in the back.
And it was thought that it was filmed in New York, but it's just outside Fountain Court where Blake lived and died. And Ginsberg clearly took Dylan there to see where Blake had lived and died in his final house. That is an ending.
Thank you. Thank you for being gorgeous.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.